Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
My default mode is being a little apologetic and a bit of a people pleaser, and Phil is as far away from that as possible. He is a cerebral character, by the way. He's, he's a classic scholar. He may dress and talk like folk, but it's a masquerade for a highly intelligent, highly calculating, at times monstrous psychology, but really underneath all that, a flawed, damaged human being, a child in arrested development.
Hello and welcome to The Awardist from Entertainment Weekly, taking you inside the year's top contenders for the Oscars and more of the industry's biggest awards. I'm Josh Rothkopf, EW's Senior Movies Editor. I'm joined by my co-host, Clarissa Cruz, EW's Executive Editor. Hi, Clarissa.
Hi, Josh. Today we have a very special guest. He's best known for Smarty Pants characters like Doctor Strange, Sherlock Holmes, and scientist Alan Turing. But Benedict Cumberbatch will be joining us to talk about his very different role in Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog, in theaters now and on Netflix December 1st. When the film premiered at the Venice Film Fest, Benedict quickly shot to the front of the Best Actor race, and we talk about his process, working with acclaimed director Jane Campion, and how he inhabited his surly, sometimes terrifying cowboy character. But first, let's talk about the category in general, Best Actor. Josh, who are you liking this year?
I'm liking lots and lots of candidates. I do definitely think that Benedict Cumberbatch has an amazing chance at winning this. Don't you think he's pretty much one of the front runners?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, he was terrifying. I wouldn't say that this is a warm and cuddly character at all, but he completely inhabited this role, which I was a little surprised by because he's sort of known for playing more kind of cerebral characters. But as he points out in our interview later, this character, Phil Burbank, is pretty cerebral in his own way, but just terrifying in a whole other way.
Yeah, he is cerebral, right? He's supposed to have gone to Yale and studied classics. And I love the performance. You know what it reminded me of? It felt a little like Jack Nicholson, that kind of wolfish, almost late period Jack Nicholson, where there's a real sense of danger to his performance, like a real coiled sense of explosiveness. And yeah. Obviously, without giving anything away, there's a lot of buried subtext that I think Benedict does an amazing job mining over the course of the film. I also think we should be mentioning Will Smith as a definite front runner as well for his performance in King Richard as Richard Williams, the coach of a young Venus and Serena Williams. I was pretty knocked out by that movie. I have to say, it is a crowd pleaser and an inspirational sports movie. So it does tick off certain boxes, but it worked for me. It worked for me in a surprisingly solid way. And I think Will Smith is doing some of the most impressive acting he's done here, maybe since Ali in 2001, where he's not doing sentimental. He's not doing gooey. He's obviously not doing a comedy either. This is another one of these internal, kind of conflicted performances that I think he used to do more of in the beginning of his career. I'm one of those people who thinks 6 Degrees of Separation is still his best performance.
Obviously, Richard Williams and Phil Burbank, who's Benedict Cumberbatch's character, they're very different. But I think as actors, both of them made a choice that I think was really interesting in that they stayed in character.
During the
shoot and between takes. And Benedict talks about this a little bit, but basically Jane Campion introduced him to the cast before they started filming and said, okay, this is Benedict Cumberbatch. You're going to meet him at the end of the shoot because he's going to be Phil this whole time. I thought that was a pretty cool choice, but I bet it wasn't easy on his fellow castmates.
Probably pretty painful, but when you do that kind of a method dive, it does result in Oscars often. Maybe on a complete opposite side of process, Andrew Garfield, I was shocked to discover in Tick, Tick, Boom that he is a musical theater geek, or at least plays one really persuasively.
I had no idea. I really had no idea. Like, I never saw this side of him. So I was pleasantly surprised when I saw him really belt it out in this movie.
Completely persuasively, right? And he plays Jonathan Larson, and Jonathan Larson is the real life creator of Rent. And the movie, directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, is a sort of homage and a biopic almost about the beginning of his career and his is struggling to make a dent in musical theater and have a play produced. And Andrew Garfield really kind of socks this one over, right? I mean, he's singing. There are a lot of musical numbers. He's bringing the kind of emotion that we've seen him do in movies like The Social Network and Never Let Me Go. But he's also just, I mean, if he's not doing jazz hands in a shot, he's expressing it in his eyes, because this is a very live wire, kind of a electrifying performance. And I think that anyone who even remotely loves Broadway or musical theater is going to find something to connect with in Tick, Tick, Boom. The movie, I think, as a whole, isn't perfect. And maybe we can say that Lin-Manuel Miranda, as a director, has a bit of a ways to go as in terms of movie craft. But I think his performances are spot on. And Garfield is dynamite in the film.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of surprises, is Joaquin Phoenix. Just because the last role that he did was obviously Joker. And in Come On, Come On, he sort of plays the complete opposite end of the spectrum in that movie. And I just thought he was so fantastic. It was very understated. It was very natural. I mean, I dare say cuddly. But I liked cuddly Joaquin, and I really love this movie. And I thought the chemistry that he had with his young co-star Woody Norman was fantastic. And I just really liked seeing this side of him.
Absolutely. And I think that Joker was actually kind of a surprise for me. This performance in Come On, Come On is really what I think of when I think of Joaquin. I think of movies like Two Lovers and The Yards, and the way he's able to, he has a kind of a shaggy vulnerability that I've always loved. I always feel his performances are very approachable. There's a sense of self-deprecation and humor in the character he's playing in Come On, Come On that I found like instantly likable. And I'm glad that what I consider to be the real Joaquin is back. You know, I really do hope he breaks into the bracket.
Yeah, me too.
He's on the bubble. Yeah. So let me ask you, let's forget about Oscars. Let's forget about front runners for a second. If there was a performance that you would like to advocate for, maybe a long shot that doesn't have as much of a chance, who would that be?
I'm going to go out there and say Simon Rex in Red Rocket, because I you know, obviously knew more about him from you know, we always date ourselves on these shows, Josh, and I knew him as a VJ back in the day, and then so seeing him, you know, years and years and years later in this role was surprising to me, and I thought as soon as I started watching, I completely forgot about that because he completely inhabited this role as this sort of washed up porn star, motor mouth, and you know, just hustler. And I thought he was so great. I really enjoyed the film as a whole, but thought that his performance was the key to the whole thing. And you kind of root for him even through all of the things that he does. And I think that is a credit to him as an actor.
It is a credit to him. And the conception of Red Rocket is such a dangerously ugly one in the sense that it is about a malignant narcissist who's everyone who falls into his orbit is destroyed or exploited, that it really needed someone likable, someone who could bring the charm. And I think Simon Rex is such a perfect choice in that regard. I mean, he's somebody who has worked on comedies directed by David Zucker, like who directed Airplane and the Scary Movies, and he's somebody who understands that comedy has a way of breaking if we don't, as audience members, identify or at least like the main character. So I feel like he has these chops that he's bringing to bear. I love that choice.
Yeah. What about you?
If I had to pick a long shot, this is a, you know, I know I might be on my own here. But I really do think that Matt Damon is due an Oscar. Mm-hmm. I thought he was so incredible in The Martian, and I feel like he hasn't really had an opportunity to go deep and dark in a long time. In Tom McCarthy's Stillwater, Matt Damon is playing an Oklahoma working man, a very quiet, rough, brusque character, not a verbal character, who actually has to go to France and protect his daughter, who's actually in jail, and mount a legal defense on her behalf and get a lawyer to assist with that. And so basically the movie is kind of like, you could call it like an ugly American abroad, but ugly American isn't quite right. It's more like it's a very rare performance of almost like it's like a Trump American, like a red state American.
Mm-hmm. Or as Leah puts it, a MAGA daddy.
A MAGA daddy. I like
that a lot. Like, Leah, our critic, when she got out of Stillwater, described Matt Damon as MAGA daddy, which I thought was very apt.
That is apt. And actually, it's worth stressing that Damon brings a lot of dignity to the character. There's nothing demeaning or looking down at this character. There's actually a lot of, reserve and finesse that he's bringing to this performance. And by the end of it, we really come to like and appreciate this man, not just as a protector of his daughter, but just as somebody who's reckoning with forces that are really beyond his experience. And it's about the power of fatherhood. It's about the commitments that we make to family, and also about how cultures that are far apart on the globe aren't really that different the more we examine them. It really was, in its own way, it's a really fascinating follow-up to Spotlight. And I wish that performance was having more buzz behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad you brought him up, because I really enjoyed him in that movie too. And for whatever reason, the buzz sort of died on that one, and he's, no one's talking about him in this race. But I really thought he was great. I mean, the choices that he made, I think it's harder to sort of communicate what you have to communicate as an actor when your character is so still. Yeah. And he just communicated so much in his mannerisms, in his silence, in, his choice to wear those sunglasses over his cap, just all these little details in this performance. And so I wish people were talking about it more, but I agree with you there 100%.
Yeah. I know that Damon will one day be up at that podium. He's got so much talent, and he just has to find the right role. Is Will Smith, do you think he's the one to beat?
I mean, Benedict is up there too. And so is Denzel, which we haven't mentioned yet, who's absolutely fantastic in Macbeth. But I do think Will is the one to beat. I mean, I think his film just sort of has that very kind of broader, wider appeal. And so more people, I think, are going to connect with it. And his performance is really good. I mean, he disappears into this character, and it's not, I mean, as you said before, it's a multifaceted character. There's a lot of internal struggle going on. And I think this is his strongest performance in a long time. And I think people do like him and want to give him this, and he's making the rounds. So I would say he's the one to beat.
I definitely would agree with that. And I feel like there is a certain insider Hollywood vibe to this where people say, oh, he's due. I think people have wanted to give Will Smith an Oscar, but the performances were never quite there. I don't think anyone seeing King Richard would have any doubts about that performance being worthy. It's just that he's got some tough competition. And when you really suss it out in terms of the voting block of actors in AMPUS, is the largest voting block, just in terms of numbers, a lot of people will be seeing King Richard. But I do think that the other ones we've mentioned, especially Joaquin Phoenix and Benedict Cumberbatch, they're in films that the entire acting branch is going to get behind. If you're talking about Come On, Come On and The Power of the Dog, there are multiple potential nominees in those films. And so this really is a horse race this year. In King Richard, there are a number of performances that we like, and not just your internet boyfriend.
John Bernthal. He's really good. Not just because of my boyfriend, but I think he completely transforms. I mean, who would have thought the Punisher could ever be Rick Macy? I mean, they couldn't physically be any more different. And he's fantastic in that. And I think especially his scenes between him and Will, where they sort of have to go head to head with each other. And, you know, Will always sort of wins. But I think those scenes are really fun and electrifying, and there's just great chemistry all around there.
Yeah, all these best actor potentials that we've named have great sparring scenes. I mean, you could say Benedict Cumberbatch has amazing scenes with Kirsten Dunst, and the always quietly impressive Jesse Plemons.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you think about Joaquin Phoenix and the acting he's doing with Woody Norman, it's so hard to act across a child actor, a child performer who is... You know, I mean, that almost in a way is kind of like co-directing. And Joaquin is really evincing an amazing performance out of Woody in that film.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of child actors, because this is someone that has been placed in the best actor race. I mean, that's what they're going to campaign for, is Jude Hill in Belfast.
Right.
And I thought that was a really interesting choice, because Focus is getting behind them in that category. What do you think about that?
I think that that's an amazing choice, actually. And he's, if you really want to identify who the main character is, it's clear that it's Jude's character. It's the whole film is a memoir. It's written by Kenneth Branagh, the director, and it's his boyhood memories of growing up movie mad in Belfast in the late 60s during the Troubles. And so that I forget the name. I think his name is, he's called Buddy, right?
Yeah, Jude? Buddy.
Mm-hmm. Buddy. Yeah. And obviously that's a stand-in for Kenneth Branagh, a young Kenneth Branagh. I feel like he is, Aristotle would say he's the main character for sure. And so I am 100% with this. This is not an example of category fraud. I really do think that Belfast is, Belfast does have amazing performances across the board. I was a little more impressed with the performances on the margin. It's not to say I didn't like Jude's performance, but there have been some truly astounding child performances this year and last year, really, when you think about it. And so it's not quite of that caliber. When you think of performances by young people, I mean, personally, I think of Haley Joel Osment in The Sixth Sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think about the performances in Jojo Rabbit, which were excellent, from Thomas and McKenzie.
Yeah.
And so it really does take someone special to break out of just, did you think that Jude did that in this case?
I think this is interesting. I much preferred Woody Norman in Come On, Come On. And it's funny, I was talking with Leah about this, and we're like, we should do a children's heat index, but that actually sounds wrong. There are a lot of child actors that I thought were great, starting with Woody. I thought Jude did a good job, but I don't know. There was just such, I think, a naturalness to Woody's performance that I thought was really, I think it's really impressive for someone that age. And then I learned that he was also British, which, you know, he plays an American in the movie. And so, you know, not that kids can't do accents, but like it never wavered. That's not what I was focused on at all, but I just thought he was really good. He reminded me a little bit of Noah Jupe, who I think is fantastic and such a great actor. And he was in Honey Boy and also Ford v. Ferrari. I mean, he had two big roles that year. And I think he's just a fantastic actor.
He is. He's also in a reboot of The Lost Boys that's coming soon.
No way. That is like my favorite movie ever. I can't believe he's in it. I'm so on board for that.
Yeah, me too. That was definitely formative, I think, in my youth. In terms of best actor, let's get back to the race. Are there surprises that you've seen in history that you remember like as favorites?
Yeah, well, there's one that was really recent, not last year. I think we were all surprised. Or maybe you weren't, Josh. I don't know. We never talked about this. But yeah, Chadwick Boseman being beat up by Anthony Hopkins for The Father.
I definitely think that was a surprise. And obviously they waited till the very end of the broadcast, which just sort of ended awkwardly because it was supposed to be this wonderful tribute to an actor that we all love and miss. But If I'm being completely honest, I think that was Anthony Hopkins' best performance. Mm-hmm. I think it's better than Silence of the Lambs. I think it's better than Remains of the Day. And it shows an actor at the peak of his powers, even at that advanced age. I think that he's doing dynamite work in that film. I love The Father. It wrecked me. So it was that kind of situation where I was like, oh, what a worthy win it would have been for Anthony Hopkins, but I'm sure he won't win. And then when he did win, there was almost like no one there to see it.
Yeah. The Oscar producers, even they didn't think that it was going to happen. They thought it was going to end on the Chadwick win. So that was a big surprise. And then another one, now we're going way back, but Roberto Benigni. I feel like that was a surprise because I think he was supposed to be like, I think it was the same year that Tom Hanks was
for Saving Private Ryan.
And so I thought that was a big surprise. It was a very entertaining and fun surprise because I don't know, was that when he was walking on the seats or was that when he said he was going to make love to each everybody? Like,
virtually every other nominee was, I think had more heat. I mean, I remember Nick Nolte was also up for that award. And yet here's, you know, Benigni kind of, and you couldn't help but love him when he was just like jumping over seats and making that speech. That was wonderful.
Yeah.
The best actor win that I think I remember most fondly is Adrian Brody in The Piano, right? I think that was in the 2003 ceremony for films that came out in 2002. And he was not really predicted to win. He was running. He was in a bracket against Daniel Day-Lewis for Gangs of New York, and Daniel Day-Lewis always wins, but it resulted in this incredible win. And that Brody is just so magnificent in that film. It's a hard film, but he was, and then also that win I think also brought us one of the most classic Oscar moments I think of the telecast when he got up on stage and I think Halle Berry was presenting the award because she had won the previous year and he gives her this big smooch and it's a dip and everyone remembers that moment.
Classic Me Too moment.
It's a moment that could only happen in a pre-Me Too universe. But right. I think Adrian Brody was a very worthy winner in that. He has had a little bit of the curse of the Oscar hanging over his career ever since. Although, God, I loved seeing him on Succession last week. That was great. Okay, after the break, we will be hearing from Benedict Cumberbatch, star of The Power of the Dog and a definite frontrunner in this year's Best Actor race.
No one the more about gel coat.
When the fourth round would...
Don't you call in the...
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with the Awardist podcast Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
Great to see you, Benedict.
Great to see you, too.
Thank you for speaking with us. We are a huge fan of this movie. When I first saw it, I was devastated, and I mean that in the best way. It was just such an amazing film and amazing performance from you. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell me, you know, how you came to play Phil. I mean, you're known for very sort of cerebral roles, you know, Doctor Strange, Alan Turing, Sherlock Holmes. I mean, this is very different. What drew you to it?
Jane Campion came to me and we sort of had a discussion, which I thought was a prequel to an audition, and it turned out to kind of be it. We looked at a lookbook. She talked about how she wanted to centralize that period and that world and bring to life the interior struggle of this very complex man and place him at the center of this drama and honor Thomas Savage's brilliant novel. And I said, this one, it's just, it all sounds wonderful. And there was a bit of a gap in the conversation. I went, so are we doing this? And she went, yeah, I just wanted to meet my Phil. And I got on the phone, I went, oh my God, I think Jane just offered me the role. And she got on her phone to her producer, Tanya. I said, oh my God, I think I've just offered Benedict the role. So it kind of, it happened at the beginning of what turned out to be a very long and brilliant and beautiful and just revelatory conversation with an extraordinary filmmaker. You know, I kind of came to him through the discovery that was very much in tandem with her, actually, in a way that I've never worked with a director before. We really went about trying to honor Thomas Savage's extraordinary literary invention based on a real life character from his family. We just really wanted to make the best out of this. And Tanya Sagachin, the producer, and everyone involved, really facilitating, really encouraging and supportive of me shifting myself from, I wouldn't say cerebral characters, but just let's put it this way. My default mode is being a little apologetic and a bit of a people pleaser, and Phil is as far away from that as possible. He is a cerebral character, by the way. He's, he's a classic scholar. He may dress and talk like folk, but it's a masquerade for a highly intelligent, highly calculating, at times monstrous psychology. But really, underneath all that, a flawed, damaged human being, a child in arrested development. And then there was just this wonderful synchronicity to it all, I guess. The conversation continued. We had an amazing sort of boot camp in New Zealand. But before that, I went on Dude Camp. She said, look, what do you feel insecure about? What are the challenges? And I said, where do I begin, Jane? I mean, you know, I've got to play the banjo. I've got to roll a cigarette with one hand. I've got to be an expert horse rider. I've done a bit of that. But she went, well, you know, we'll get you music lessons. And I went, that's cool. And I'll try and roll a cigarette by the time we start the film. But I think I need to be inured in this place and this time somehow outside of my imagination. And Montana was offered, you know, this amazing experience I had with Randy and his wife, Jen, a really experienced cowboy who's a master horseman, an amazing artisan who makes the most beautiful rope that's revered and lusted after around the world in the traditional form. And he taught me how to treat a hide, cut it, treat it again, bevel it, how to straighten it, and then how to stretch it and start making rope, basically, and then use rope and horse ride and steer cattle in two different ranches that he took me to in Montana in the weeks I was there. Amazing, amazing places with amazing men and women who were incredibly eager to help me authenticate the experience of Phil Burbank for the screen. And yeah, I learned a lot. I felt Bronco in certain people I met. I felt Phil in certain people I met. It was just a really mind-blowing experience, and so far away from my lived one that was a good window into what that life would have been like and is like now. And then, you know, during the filming, she just gave me full permission to be him. She introduced me to the cast, I mean, to the crew, sorry, as Phil. I said, look, Benedict's very nice. We meet him at the end of the shoot. This is Phil. You're working with him. Mm-hmm. That was it. She gave me full permission to.
Were you surprised by that?
I sort of asked her. I said, look, I want to go the whole way with you, but I think you've got to explain it. She went, oh, you're such a people pleaser. I said, I think I am, and I'm very apologetic. I don't want to make grown men and women suffer an actor, forcing them to call them by their character name unless it's something that's kind of mutually accepted and talked about and agreed at the beginning. Yeah, she introduced me as Phil, and that was it. The first day was hard. The internal critic was far louder than the kind of confidence or the voice of Phil, the work we'd done, saying, you can't do this. Who do you think you are masquerading as this embittered, twisted, malignant, but wronged and tortured soul, this wronged man who's in such pain? How can you bring all of this masculinity? You don't own it, you know, self-doubt. I mean, a lot of people have that on the first day, but it was very, very loud. But by the end of that day, I'd owned a bit of it at least, and then just took the next step and with more and more confidence.
Were you the only one that stayed sort of in your character, or did they all do it?
I think everyone did to a degree, you know. And I mean, even previous jobs, I've worked with a far shorter runway of building the airplanes. It's kind of taking off. And like I said, we had more prep for this. But even in production, in shooting, I've often had this feeling of having to switch it on and off very fast, whether it's because I'm a producer and have other hats to wear or just because of the nature of the way the group, the collective, and the director have created the working atmosphere. But when I'm on, that's it. I'm that character. I don't see that as being any different from the methodology I used in this, apart from it being longer, it being more about the entire day. And yeah, I think that's really the difference. It was just, it's the longest I've ever been in character. But, you know, we're in New Zealand. There are all sorts of technical reasons. I wasn't surrounded by America or Americans. So there was that to hold on to the character for, but also how far away, I guess, he is from me. And just to try and give as much possibility to being him as I possibly could, you know? And that just meant slightly different all-day approach as opposed to on and off.
You mentioned being a people pleaser, apologetic. I mean, did you end up, on weekends or after the shoot, apologizing to Cody and Kirsten?
I did. I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm body shaming you. I'm torturing you psychologically. It's so horrible. They're like, it's the job. You know, they're very cool about it. What a job. It's an amazing job. But yeah, there are times where you kind of go, wow, okay. It's a heavy thing to do on a day, and you kind of want to reconnect with the human beings who you're playing with, just to reassure them that it's not, you know, there's no sort of subsidiary joy to it. It's a job. So yeah, I did. I reconnected at the weekends, and we're really good friends, and we all got it. We're all on the same page. It's three brilliant, brilliant actors for me to be doing this work with, and they were incredibly supportive of me and what I needed to get there.
Well, let's get back into your prep, because all the stuff that you detailed sounds so fascinating. And I wanted to start with that lookbook that you were mentioning that Jane made. What was in it, and what did you get from it?
Sort of unexpectedly sensual pictures of the era, whether it was cowhands relaxing by a kind of a stream or a levee or a little lake, or whether it was these sort of odd semi-erotic photographs, half in shade, half exposed in light, of men posing, glimpses of sort of eroticism, and then just some really beautiful archival photographs of rodeos and cattle drives and a different sort of performative aspects, uniform, but also celebratory in their clothing and their manner. Yeah, it just got me really excited. I thought, what an amazing woman to enjoy this with, because she's got such a profound understanding of landscape, of sensuality within a frame, of the intimacy of a character, but also the alienation within that landscape, as witnessed in the piano, for example. I thought, what a brilliant, brilliant person to be tackling this subject matter in this milieu. You know, I'm so excited to be in her and Ari's work. And Ari and her had been dialoguing for like a year before we started production. So they were so in control, but also incredibly loose and free to express and adapt and go from a expensive crane shop to going, no, you know, it's a really simple thing in this corner over here. And it's very bold to do that. Mm-hmm. As filmmakers, and really had that fluidity about them. And it was very easy to be in their frame. And then there were other moments where it was about them following me and trusting them and just letting whatever I had as Phil in those moments in the private arena of his life, which is a very narrow window, but a very profound window into who he really is in what we call the sacred place. And it was wonderful. The intimacy of that, just me and Jane and Ari, was a thing of really bonding trust and just throwing the work out there and letting something flow through and letting her capture it.
Yeah. What was it like sort of being, what was the vibe on the set? I mean, two strong women sort of helming everything. And how does it compare to other experiences you've had with other directors and cinematographers?
Yeah, I mean, it's strange. I had a similar experience with Eric and Will Sharpley directed The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne. For me, it's not really about gender. It's just about sensitivity and appreciation for the balance of needs on a set. You know, there are lots of people with lots of questions. Lots of people need lots of time. It's not just about actors. It's not just about the camera. It's everything. It's all of it all together. And Jane's just a superlative director. She's been a champion and shown people that women have every right to be behind the camera just as much as men do, and proven it with extraordinary work in her career. But on a day-to-day shoot, you know, she just, it doesn't sing to me as being a different feeling, you know? I mean, maybe I've been lucky and I haven't worked with sort of hyper-masculine directors. There's always been a sensitivity and a kindness and a regard for people's needs that wouldn't be a counter to the kind of generous gentleness and command that Ari and Jane had. I wouldn't say, no, gender really doesn't play, you know, Jane just has an exceptional talent. And I think what she's tackled in her films before, you know, for me, everyone going, oh, you're the first male lead in a Jane Campion film. How does that feel? I wouldn't know how it's, what to compare it to. You know, it's for people outside to judge it objectively, I think, but subjectively when you're in it, it's just, she's a phenomenal director. She facilitates process. She brings out such raw, direct and honest performances from her actors, and that's immediately one of the appeals of wanting to work with Jane. And she does it in all sorts of ways, some very peculiar, some very left field, some very direct. You know, she got Jesse and I to waltz to just bring together our bodies and create an intimacy between two brothers who, while pushing and pulling against each other in the drama, have lived a life tied at the hip of codependency. And the oddity of that for us now, you know, something we have to break through and get to the a sort of feeling of the sensuality of. It was a great idea. It was sort of bizarre and giggly and fun, but there was also a profound connection that happened in that moment, and came out of a you know, sweet but strange suggestion. You know, that's something I would say. Jane's not afraid, and I think some men are, but Jane really isn't afraid of her vulnerability, and that really encourages you to expose yours, to be free with that, and not to... you have to realize that we're all taking risks. And if someone of Jane's capacity and experience can feel fear and share that, that's actually a real call to arms. It's a real, to be honest about your vulnerability. I mean, that's kind of where this character has to get to.
You know, I just thought your performance was so fearless.
Thank you.
Did anything scare you about it as you were doing it?
Oh God, all of it. I mean, I described my first day nerves, but you know, all of it. I mean, you know, doing a whistle and it just coming out as air and no sound, fudging a cigarette, any moments, and the banjo. I mean, the banjo is the most sort of skilled thing I really had to do in it. And anytime I hit a bum note or just it sounded off, it would bring me out, you know, and that makes you feel very vulnerable when you're trying to do something that requires a lifetime's worth of skill and you've only had a few months. There's nothing like playing a musical instrument to bring you up short. But and I think, you know, being physically and psychologically free in those private moments, that took a bit of a leap. That was a day that was coming up. It was sort of a build in my head. But actually on the day, it was very, very liberating. And it's remarkable what that does, the freedom it gives you to be that exposed as a character. It just kind of, it loosens everything. And like I said, I had so much support, and I was working with someone who felt equally anxious about what she was doing at times, and to hold her hand and run into the fire and jump off the cliff together, or whatever the stronger metaphor is, that's an amazing thing. And to have that friendship and that collaboration is gold. And that's Jane.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by, Benedict. The Power of the Dog is in theaters now and hits Netflix on December 1st. And that's it for this episode of The Awardist. If you liked what you heard, subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation with us going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials at EW on Twitter and Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at ClarissaNYC1 and Josh Rothkopf. We'll see you next week.
This episode of the Awardist podcast is hosted by Clarissa Cruz and Josh Rothkopf, produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio, executive produced by Shayna Crockmall, edited and mixed by Sammy Junio and Lauren Klein. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.